from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend.
I want to learn how to make movies.
And the movies this character wants to make are porn. Today, Maggie Gyllenhaal talks about her role on the HBO series The Deuce, playing a sex worker in the 1970s who gets off the streets by acting in and directing porn films. And we'll talk about the evangelical Christian purity movement with Linda K. Klein. Her book is about being raised in the movement. She signed an abstinence pledge to protect her virginity until marriage.
I remember feeling that it was quite serious that I was signing a contract and that that contract would be there in perpetuity.
Also, Justin Chang reviews the new comic western The Sisters Brothers, starring John C. Reilly and Joaquin Phoenix as a pair of outlaw siblings.
Hey! This is The Sisters Brothers! You don't stand a chance!
First news. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Maggie Gyllenhaal stars in the HBO series The Deuce, about the intersection of sex workers, pornography, organized crime, the police, politicians, and feminists in the Times Square area of Manhattan in the 1970s. It's also about changing attitudes toward sex in that period and how pornography became more mainstream. The series was co-created by David Simon, who also created The Wire and co-created Tremé. Gyllenhaal plays Eileen, who uses the working name Candy. In season one, which was set in the early 70s, Candy was a sex worker who found her customers on the street, but prided herself on never having worked for a pimp. After she was beaten up by a John, she tried to find a safer alternative. She started acting in cheap porn films, became fascinated by how films are made, and decided she wanted to direct. Season 2 skips ahead to 1977, when porn has become more mainstream. Candy has been acting in and directing porn films, but she wants more control over the stories and wants them to reflect a woman's point of view. In this scene from last Sunday's episode, she's on set and unhappy about the latest film script and the fantasies they're creating. She tells that to her boss, the porn's film producer, Harvey, played by David Krumholtz.
I'm not doing this anymore.
Doing what?
Doing this. Priests, nuns, rabbis.
You're religious now?
No, it just offends me.
Well, I stayed up all night writing this scene. Ask John.
Come on, Harvey. This whole script is...
Hey, I'm trying to say something about organized religion in this movie. It's a statement piece.
Yeah, saying what exactly?
Anything else?
Yeah. I'm not doing any more Daddy Knows Best scenes.
That's a fantasy.
That's not my fantasy.
Oh, that's someone's fantasy.
Hey, Harvey, you want me to keep banging out films for you? You gotta give me some better to work with, and you have got to let me start drawing some lines for myself. Otherwise...
All right. Absolutely.
I've also been thinking about something else.
A note to parents, we'll be talking about sex work in the porn industry, and you may not find it appropriate for young children. A little later, we'll talk about Maggie Gyllenhaal's starring role in the new film The Kindergarten Teacher, which opens in theaters and starts streaming on Netflix October 12th. Gyllenhaal started acting as a teenager. Her mother is a screenwriter and producer, her father a director. Her brother is actor Jake Gyllenhaal. Maggie Gyllenhaal, welcome to Fresh Air. Welcome back.
Thank you.
I think you're so terrific in this series. Was it difficult for you to decide whether to take the role? On the one hand, you have like David Simon, co-creator of The Wire and Tremé, and two great writers, Richard Price and George Pelicanos, who among their other credits wrote for The Wire. On the other hand, it's about the sex industry, and you play a sex worker who enters the porn biz first as an actress, then as a director. The subject matter gives it the potential of being exploitive of women. So what did you need to know before accepting the part and before feeling confident that you had a read on how the women characters and how you, as an actress, were going to be treated?
Yeah, I think the thing that was unusual about this project for me was that when they asked me to do it, they only had 3 scripts written. And, you know, I'm interested in the themes that this project is dealing in. You know, I didn't have a problem with playing a sex worker full stop, you know. But yeah, I felt nervous with only 3 scripts and already in the first 3 episodes, like my clothes off most of the time. And yet very, very drawn to it, very drawn to working with David and George and Richard. And also drawn to the things that were clearly on the table. You know, I mean, it was about, even from the very beginning, an imbalance of power between men and women in terms of sex, in terms of art, in terms of business. It was about desire. It was about transactional sex and the way that's kind of a part of almost every bit of our culture at this point. But, you know, I met with them, and I really wanted to do it after talking to them. I mean, David and George are so smart and interesting, but I guess I'm old enough and I've been through enough that I knew I didn't quite have enough of a guarantee that I could trust it.
So what did you ask for so that you can find out more and figure out if you could trust the material?
I asked to be a producer.
How is that going to help?
Well, basically what I wanted was to be a part of the conversation, to be in the room. You know, I've said this before, but I think it's a good way of putting it. Like, I knew they needed my body, and I wanted to make sure that they also wanted my mind. Because I thought, I'm an asset here, you know, not just as an actress, I guess. And I wanted to use that part of myself, and I thought it could be helpful to the story that they told me they were trying to tell. I really wanted to do it, you know, which was so my bargaining power wasn't like all that strong, but I had to say to myself, I'm not going to do it unless I can be a producer, because I think that will give me this other kind of guarantee in terms of storytelling. And they gave it to me, and so I did it.
So you wanted to be in on the conversation of how your character was going to be depicted, how sex was going to be depicted. Can you give us an example of one of those kind of complicated conversations and what your point of view was, what you wanted to add to the conversation?
Yeah. Even before we started, I think, looking at the first 3 scripts, I was interested in the difference between the performative sex that there was a lot of in the first 3 episodes, you know, because you're watching sex workers with their Johns. And so I thought it was important to find some place to show a real, not performative, female climax, because I felt that would then put into relief all the other stuff we've been seeing. You know, because like on TV, you see a lot of pretend sex, and it's sold to you as what it really looks like. And I don't think that's what anyone was meaning to do on the show. So I had put that into David's ear, like in a really early lunch between us, one of the first times we'd ever really talked, honestly. And he like pretended to spit his water into his you know, glass. So anyway, you know, he's very funny and he's great at kind of deflecting and yet totally taking in ideas that are worthwhile. I mean, it's been such an interesting collaboration between us. So I said that to him. I didn't see anything about it. Then in episode 5, there's a scene, you know, which is months after we had this discussion, where Candy's dating a straight guy, somebody who's not paying her. And it's never going to work out between them. And that's part of what this scene is about. But inside that scene, David had written that they're making love. He climaxes and she doesn't. And she turns over and makes herself climax. And it was very important to me that it be as real and as not performed as possible. And so, I mean, I have to tell you, it was like, without a doubt, the most vulnerable thing I have ever done on screen. Obviously, I'm pretending, but I felt
so vulnerable. I'd never seen anything like that in a movie or on TV before. And we all were so happy at the end of the scene. It was almost like a one-act play, the scene. And we were like, we did it. We did what David said to me. He said, we did what we said we wanted to do. And I felt so good. And then as a producer, I'm given early cuts of the episodes. And I see an early cut, and it's a great scene. And they cut out Candy's climax. And I was like... I was so upset. I was so confused. I was like up all night. I really was literally up all night. And I wrote this, you know, many paragraph long dissertation as to why they had to put it back in, and stopped David and George and Nina, the other producer on set, and found them and, you know, explained to them again what I'd said in my email, and they put it back in.
One of the issues in The Deuce is how, on the porn sets, to treat women respectfully while having them perform sex. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I imagine applies also to filming The Deuce, because the actors like you have to perform sex scenes, and I'm sure you insisted on being treated respectfully, though maybe you didn't need to insist. Maybe that was just a kind of given on set. But were there conversations you had around that, as like how should the actors and actresses be treated so as not to violate them in any way while shooting these scenes? And ditto for the scenes when you were a sex worker working the streets.
Mm-hmm. You know, we as a crew and as actors learned a lot about this as we went the first season. And, of course, in between the first season and the second season, there was the Time's Up movement, which brought to light a lot of things that I think people didn't want to see before that. It made it impossible not to see, and made a lot of things explicit. So the intention was always from everybody to be as respectful as possible. Season one, I was one of the people who was always, you know, I mean, I had my clothes off all the time. I was doing these simulated sex scenes. And I realized for me, the most important thing was to have a physical barrier between me and the day player who I'd never met before, who I was doing this scene with. So we sort of fashioned, I mean, there was nothing like this before. I mean, like, I was like, what do they use on girls? You know, can we call them?
On the TV series Girls?
Yeah, it was like, they must know. What do you what protection do you use? How do you do this? I mean, I've done a lot of sex scenes in my career, but I mean, not quite like these with strangers, you know, and that was something that was hard to do it with strangers. It's very intimate. So we fashioned this kind of thing that would keep, you know, protect us physically from actually being even in contact through thin layers of clothes. Feels like too much, you know? You need something real to protect you. So we figured that out and we shared it with everybody. But really, the second season, I think we made a really big change, which was amazing, which was that I had been to some meetings of actresses talking about things, simple things that we could change on sets. And someone suggested at one of them that, you know, when you do a fight scene in a movie or a play, there is always a stunt guy there, always, to make sure you're physically and emotionally protected. If something doesn't feel comfortable to you, you can go to the stunt guy. In fact, they even look and see if after the stunt you might be sort of unconsciously rubbing a part of your arm or something, and they'll come and say, are you all right? Did that hurt? And an actress at one of these meetings suggested, why don't we have that for sex scenes? And so on The Deuce, in the second season, we did. We had this woman who was the intimacy coordinator, we called her. And she would call the actors the night before. She'd say, I'm here to make you comfortable. And this is what your contract says. Do you still feel comfortable with that? Because you don't have to do it. And then she would be there. She would help with the choreography of the sex scenes, and she would check in with people. And the truth is, for me, I, like you said, I feel like I can say, oh, this doesn't feel right. Hold on, something's off. I do know how to protect myself at this point. But I felt for people who were coming in for one day, who are so happy to have the gig and, you know, don't feel comfortable saying, who might not feel as comfortable as I do saying, no, I actually don't feel okay with this anymore. That's what she was there for. And I read this piece, actually, that one actress wrote in the New York Times about coming on our set and how great she felt with Alicia. You know, I was like, that's what Alicia's there for.
Is there anything from the physical barrier that you came up with that is describable on radio with radio standards?
Well, basically, it was a piece of a yoga mat put inside a pillowcase. And we would just play the pillowcase as if it were part of the sheets and then push it out of the way in order to continue on with the scene. Because like I said, for me, it wasn't nudity so much. I like the idea of what a human body brings with it artistically to a worthwhile story. And my body, I mean, I'm 40. I like that. I don't know. I really didn't mind including my body in the storytelling I was doing, but I wanted protection from, like, you know, people I barely met physically, you know? So that was a good solution for me.
Yeah, and you mentioned day players. There's a lot of day players because all of the Johns, some of the characters in the porn films, they don't figure into other episodes. So they are the day players who the women characters are having sex with.
Right. And the idea is, I mean, if you want to make it not Pretty Woman,
right.
Well, then in a way you have to show, okay, there's this guy. And then 2 hours later, there's this guy. And then there's this guy. And then there's this guy. And that was a part of it. And it wasn't easy.
My guest is Maggie Gyllenhaal. She stars in the HBO series The Deuce. She also stars in the new movie The Kindergarten Teacher, which opens in theaters and starts streaming on Netflix October 12th. We'll talk more after a break, and Justin Chang will review the new comic western, The Sisters Brothers, starring Joaquin Phoenix, John C. Reilly, Riz Ahmed, and Jake Gyllenhaal. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross, back with Maggie Gyllenhaal. She stars in the HBO series The Deuce, about the intersection of sex workers, pornography, organized crime, the police, politicians, and feminists in the Times Square area of Manhattan in the 1970s. It's also about changing attitudes towards sex in that period and how pornography became more mainstream. Gyllenhaal also stars in the new movie The Kindergarten Teacher, which opens in theaters and starts streaming on Netflix October 12th. Let's talk about that film a little bit. It might seem like, oh, night and day, she's a sex worker and porn director and the deuce and a kindergarten teacher in The Kindergarten
Teacher.
Although
I do love that very odd job trajectory.
Yes, except that you have some serious problems in The Kindergarten Teacher. And because the character you play is somebody who writes poetry, and that's really what she wants to do, but no one takes any notice of her poems. And she finds a strange outlet for her poetic creativity and impulses. Do you want to explain what it is you'd want audiences to know without giving too much away?
Yeah, I mean, I think The Kindergarten Teacher is a movie about, you know, what are the consequences, the real consequences of starving a vibrant woman's mind. And it's told by a group of women filmmakers. And so, in our opinion, the consequences are really dire. And it is kind of an allegory. It's a thriller. It's almost like a horror movie in some ways. It's you know, what she does and the line she crosses and what ends up happening to her are in a way they're an exaggeration. But I think what's important in the story is that she's somebody just like us. You know, she could certainly be a friend of mine, and yet she gets very confused because her mind is starving, and she starts to think that a child in her kindergarten class is a poetic genius, and she gets obsessed with him.
And it's not like he's writing poetry. He's just like walking back and forth, saying things that she thinks really are poems, and she writes them down.
Right, and you think about, like, I have a child that's exactly the same age as the boy who plays Jimmy, and children that age say incredible things. And how you frame them is, you know, that's another story. I think, I read an article or two that said, Lisa's poetry is mediocre. And I think that's really not true. I think that's the wish. I think if she's a mediocre poet, the movie's way easier to watch. Her poetry is, in fact, written by a brilliant published poet. If her poetry is really compelling and it is still not heard, then what? Then you're watching a woman, like, what do you do with your mind? And is it too much of a coincidence in my mind to then all of a sudden have a brilliant poet in her class? No, she's desperate, she's starving, and she ends up sucking off of this child as opposed to the other way around, which is how it's supposed to work, where a child is being fed from the grown-up.
You'd said that you thought the character... your character on the Deuce and your character on the kindergarten teacher had a connection. Do you want to explain now the connection that you see between the two of them?
Well, yeah. I mean, basically, I made season one of the Deuce, then I made the kindergarten teacher, and then I made season two. And I think both women, both characters, like many women right now, are waking up to the fact that they've been accepting a way of living that they're not okay with. And not only not okay with, but is keeping them from living, is keeping them from being who they are, you know? And I think that's dramatically interesting. I think a lot of characters you meet when they come to a point where they're like, I can't go on like this anymore. But I think it's related to Me Too and Time's Up, you know, this cultural moment where women are saying, I don't know how I lived like this for so long. I don't know how I accepted that. It's unacceptable. And the interesting thing is I think Candy, she's really thinking clearly. She knows what she wants. And even though it's very difficult for her to get it, I mean, she's a porn director in 1977. Before that, she's a sex worker in 71. It's not an easy path for her, and the show certainly doesn't make it easy for her. But she's on a path that makes sense, that inch by inch, setback, you know, like, be damned. She's on her way, clearly, toward feeding herself emotionally, intellectually, artistically, even financially. Whereas Lisa and the kindergarten teacher has the same, very similar needs, very similar hunger, and is not thinking clearly and is confused. And the way in which she goes about getting the things that she knows she needs is really deeply problematic. And personally, I love the idea that it's the pornographer who... thinking clearly and knows what she wants and knows how to get it, and it's the kindergarten teacher who doesn't. I mean, that's sort of more of a challenging situation, I think. And I love that they're coming out at the same time, you know, and what it means when you think about them together. I mean, I'd love them to be in a room together sometime. It'd be so interesting, you know. But anyway, that's how I think they're related. because those are the things that are on my mind.
Maggie Gyllenhaal, it's just been such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Maggie Gyllenhaal stars in the HBO series The Deuce. She also stars in The Kindergarten Teacher, which opens in theaters and begins streaming on Netflix October 12th. Coincidentally, Jake Gyllenhaal, Maggie's brother, is in a new movie too, the comic western The Sisters Brothers. It's set during the Gold Rush in 1851. John C. Reilly and Joaquin Phoenix play a pair of outlaw siblings. It's the first English-language picture from the French filmmaker Jacques Audiard, whose work on the movie recently earned him the Best Director Award at the Venice International Film Festival. Film critic Justin Chang has this review.
The title of The Sisters Brothers is both tongue-in-cheek and matter-of-fact. It's about two brothers with the last name Sisters, Eli Sisters and Charlie Sisters. The whole movie is like that, a series of deadpan jokes wrapped in a shambling, no-big-deal realism. The humor never feels arch or tacked on. It wells up naturally from the characters and the funny, stirring, brutal story in which they find themselves. Adapted from a 2011 novel by the Canadian author Patrick DeWitt, The Sisters Brothers follows a bunch of outlaws and prospectors searching for gold and deliverance across the Oregon Territory. The outlaws are Eli, played by John C. Reilly, and Charlie, played by Joaquin Phoenix. They work for a very bad man called the Commodore, whom you may recognize as the Dutch actor and B-movie veteran Rutger Hauer. Under the Commodore's employment, the brothers have made something of a name for themselves. Slovenly and unreliable though they may be, they're awfully good at killing people. Charlie is the younger, more volatile of the two brothers, and Phoenix, no stranger to wild man roles, makes him both ferocious and disorderly. Some days he's so drunk he can barely stay on his horse. Eli is the wiser, more mature one, perpetually exasperated with Charlie in a way that only a truly devoted brother could be. But even his patience wears a little thin. One night at dinner, Eli says he wants them to finish the proverbial one last job and then retire from the game. Charlie responds by hitting him, causing a scene. The next morning, he's sobered up a bit, but Eli hasn't forgiven him.
What's wrong with you?
Remember what happened last night?
Yes? And?
You remember that you hit me?
I hit you?
Stop pretending and spare me the I don't remember routine. You hit me in public, Charlie. So as sure as you're looking at me right now, I'm leaving.
No, wait. All right, what do you want? This is about slapping each other in public. So I slap you, you slap me back, we're even. So go ahead, hit me. Christ! What is your goddamn problem? I slapped you! I didn't whack you in the head with a shovel!
You do remember.
John C. Reilly gives a performance of soulful, understated tenderness in the sort of leading role I wish he'd land more often. He also has a mug worthy of a great silent comedian. There's a hilarious running gag in which Eli slowly teaches himself to use a toothbrush, still a fairly new commodity in the Old West. But while the Sisters Brothers may get top billing, they aren't the only characters of interest here. The Commodore has ordered them to track down and apprehend a gifted chemist named Herman Kermit Worm, wonderfully played by Riz Ahmed. He has invented a solution that immediately reveals the gold hidden in a body of water, eliminating the need for panning. Before the brothers can get to him, though, Herman joins forces with a thoughtful detective and fellow prospector named John Morris, played with wry eloquence by Jake Gyllenhaal. These four men are destined to cross paths and exchange a few bullets, though what happens to them next is far stranger than any of them could have expected. One of the things you notice about the Sisters Brothers is just how ridiculously likable everyone is. Okay, so Charlie's a mess, but the others, although beaten down by lives riddled with violence and persecution, maintain an optimistic spirit. Eli, tired of his life of lawlessness, just wants to settle down. The more idealistic Herman and John hope to establish a community somewhere in Texas, where peaceful, like-minded people can live in accordance with truly democratic principles. It's a pipe dream, but a beautiful one. This may be the director Jacques Audiard's first English-language production, But given his mastery of genre filmmaking, and also France's long-running love affair with the mythology of the American West, it's less of a departure than you might think. ODR revels in the iconography of the Western, the men on horseback, the gorgeous sunset vistas. The few memorable female characters we meet remain mostly on the sidelines. Rebecca Root appears as the woman who runs a town the brothers pass through, while Alison Tolman plays a prostitute who has a sweet, chaste interaction with Eli. As Odiard has shown in his past thrillers like A Prophet and The Beat That My Heart Skipped, he's primarily a poet of wounded masculinity, and here he exposes the vulnerability behind his character's rawhide tough surfaces. One of the most memorable sequences finds these four men working beside a lake, preparing the water for Herman's miracle solution, but really just hanging out, talking and bonding in a way that, you suspect, men of their time and place rarely permitted themselves to do. It's a warm respite from the harsh, painful reality of their lives and the grim fates that await most of them. The Sisters Brothers starts off looking like a rickety joke and winds up nearly breaking your heart.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the LA Times. Coming up, we'll talk about the evangelical sexual purity and abstinence movement with Linda K. Klein. Her book, Pure, is part memoir, part interviews with other women who, like her, were raised in the movement. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to talk about the evangelical sexual purity movement, its insistence on sexual abstinence before marriage, and the impact the movement has had on women who were brought up in it, women like my guest Linda K. Klein. She says the movement has traumatized many girls and maturing women who are haunted by sexual and gender-based anxiety, fear, and shame. Her new book, Pure, is part memoir, including the story of how she left the movement. The book also draws on the interviews she did with other women in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, including women from her hometown, about how the evangelical purity movement has affected their sense of identity and their sex lives. The purity movement grew in the 1980s during the Reagan administration, which funded abstinence-only programs for community organizations, schools, and health departments. A whole industry of purity-related products developed around the movement, including purity rings, T-shirts, mugs, even a purity Bible. Klein describes the purity movement as conveying the expectation that all unmarried girls and women must maintain a sexless body, mind, and heart to be pure. Klein is also the founder of Break Free Together, which tries to help people escape the sexual shame they were raised with. Linda K. Klein, welcome to Fresh Air. So the project that you undertook, and the result of that is your book, is interviewing other women who were part of the sexual purity movement, who were brought up in the movement. Describe your project and why you wanted to do it.
I was in my early 20s. I had left the evangelical church in large part because I had rejected the sexual shaming And when I left, I thought that I was going to be completely free of sexual shame and fear and anxiety that had haunted me up until that point, and discovered, quite to the contrary, that I was actually not free at all, that I had so internalized the sexual shaming that I no longer needed external shamers, that I was more than capable of shaming myself. And that was scary for me. And I worried a lot that I was broken and that I would never have a healthy relationship or be a healthy person. And it wasn't until I started to call up my girlfriends from back home in the evangelical church in which I was raised and started telling them what I was experiencing, and then sat with my jaw just dropped the floor as they told me very similar stories, you know, from their own lives, that I started to realize that I wasn't alone.
You're right. We'd gone to war with ourselves, with our bodies. So what were some of the symptoms that you had and that other women brought up in the purity movement had that you thought were very similar to PTSD?
Well, it started, you know, with nightmares. And that's incredibly common, you know, from it was common for me, but it's also something I hear a lot about from folks who I interview about this. You know, a lot of us also had this anxiety that lived in our bodies. You know, for me, that meant my eczema that comes out when I get stressed would come out when I would have sexual thoughts or feelings or make sexual choices because I, you know, had this sort of association of deep anxiety around my sexuality. Whereas some of the people I was interviewing were actually, you know, this was so physicalized that they were having panic attacks, literal panic attacks, and they were going to the hospital. You know, another example is, you know, there was a lot of fear. You know, people walked in a constant cognizance of other people's perceptions of their purity and how other people would assess them as good or bad, pure or impure. And that created, you know, for me, a fear that led me to do things that felt crazy to me, like take pregnancy tests, though I wasn't having sex, you know, because I was so afraid of my sexuality being found out, whatever sexuality I was engaging in. Whereas for other people, you know, that paranoia started to become fears of being followed when they went on dates or fears of being recorded in their own homes. So that's what I mean when I say PTSD. And the thing that probably is the most scary is, you know, for a lot of people, it was a feeling of worthlessness. And for some, that was subtle, you know, just in the background of their minds. And for others, it became so extreme that they felt that they had no choice other than to commit suicide.
You mentioned panic attacks, and in your book, you describe yourself as not quite having panic attacks, but having freakouts. When you were a young woman, after you'd left the church, you had a boyfriend, and you had talked about having sex, and you thought you were ready to do it, but every time you came close, you'd freak out.
Yeah, you know, the reality is that I thought that I was capable of making the choice of having sex. I was in my early 20s. I had a boyfriend who I loved. I really wanted to be able to express my love for him physically and felt very comfortable with making that choice. And yet, when I actually would get into a situation where, you know, we were actually beginning to go down a road toward having sex, I would have what he called freakouts. That was his term for it. And a freakout consisted of me breaking down into tears. Sometimes that eczema that I mentioned coming out and my scratching myself until I bled and ending up, you know, in a ball in the corner of the bed in a way that was deeply unsexy and that definitely prevented us from having sex.
You know, the impression I get from your book is when you're young and in the sexual purity movement, you're kind of trained to experience shame if you kiss even, and that you're preached to be pure, to not engage in sex, but when you find your partner and marry, then you should start having sex. And as one of the pastors said, men like a woman to be a lamb during the day and a tiger at night. So you're expected suddenly to be able to, like, you know, have sex and please your husband. And it's this kind of like flip-flop of what your brain is expecting from that very idea of sexuality. It seems like coping with that might be complicated.
Yeah, you know, the rules, first of all, of purity culture were always really unclear because your purity or lack thereof was defined by the community. So some members of the community would say, you know, yes, you couldn't even have an emotional intimacy with someone of the opposite sex without risking your purity before marriage. Whereas others, you know, seemed to feel that, you know, as long as you didn't have sex before marriage, you were still fine, you were still safe. So you were in this pre-stage of non-sexuality, you were constantly wondering what it was that was going to lose you your purity, right? So that's hence, I think, some of the anxiety that people were living with. You know, you're constantly awaiting the assessment of the community. But one thing that you know is that if A, then B is what we were taught. If you are pure, non-sexual to whatever extent is the requirement before marriage, then you will have a perfect, blissful, highly sexual life after marriage. You will please your husband. He will never leave you. He will never cheat on you because you will be such a sexual delight for him. And it's fascinating because, you know, this teaching doesn't really work. You know, the reality that I've learned from my interviews in particular is that if A, then A. You know, if you learn to shut down your sexuality, if you learn to train your body to experience shame to protect you from the consequences of your sexuality in your community, then A, after you get married, you often still struggle with turning your sexuality on. But, you know, when people come to pastors oftentimes with problems in their marriage and say, you know, we're having sexual issues, even, you know, having sexual shame, oftentimes, you know, the pastors will bring them back to that same old nonsensical equation, if A, then B. So they'll say, well, you're struggling in your marriage with being hypersexual. So, you know, what happened before you got married? Did you masturbate? Did you go a little further than you think you should have together? What happened with your parents? You know, what happened before this moment that you did wrong or that was done wrong to you? How are you broken that made this A then B equation not work in your life?
Let's go back and talk about your early life in the purity movement. How old were you when you started being taught about purity?
I was 13 when I joined the Evangelical Church, and I loved the church. You know, I really joined because I fell in love with the message of Jesus and the person of Jesus and the example of Jesus and the idea of radical love and radical acceptance. You know, my mom had been an evangelical since I was a baby. And so in many ways, she had raised me evangelical, though we actually attended an Episcopalian church as a family, you know, on Sundays. But she would listen to the Christian radio station and read evangelical books and had evangelical friends. And so when she raised me, you know, she really was teaching me about a personal relationship with Jesus and teaching me about emulating the person of Jesus in a very particular way that was very intimate and very beautiful and that I loved. And when I found the evangelical church and they were talking about these things at a church level, at a community level, I was so excited. It felt like coming home in so many ways.
So what were the early purity messages that you received?
The first exposure I had to the purity message was actually about gender. So gender and sexuality are deeply intertwined in the purity movement. You aren't just supposed to be sexually pure, but you are supposed to be pure in your gender expression. So women and girls are expected to be hyper-feminine, supportive followers of men and boys who are expected to be hyper-masculine leaders, you know, supportive and loving leaders, but leaders nonetheless. And if either the man or the woman or the girl or the boy strays from their gender expectation, for example, if the woman, you know, leads too much or the man becomes her follower, you know, the idea is that the whole picture topples.
Is there an example you can think of that demonstrates the kind of gender conformity that you just described?
So this was actually my first exposure. I was at a retreat, and my very first retreat, and having an incredible time, and had just made these, you know, amazing new girlfriends who were incredibly welcoming and really embodied the radical love and acceptance that I had fallen in love with in the church, that at that point seemed to be open to all. And at the very end of the retreat, one of the youth leaders, the woman who was actually our cabin mom, had pulled one of my new friends and I aside. The new friend's name was Piper. And she told the other girls to leave. This was free time, so she said, go off and do what you need to do. And she said, Piper and Linda, though, I want you to stay in the cabin and talk with me. So she and I stayed, and I remember feeling like we were in trouble, feeling like something, you know, awful had happened. And so I was going through my mind about anything we might have done wrong. And then the mom had us sit down, and she turned to me, and she said, Linda, are you having a good time here? And I was like, oh, that's all you want to say? Yes, yes, I'm having an amazing time. And then she stopped, and then she looked over me, and she looked at Piper, and she said, what is it about you that makes you so insecure that you think you have to answer all the Bible questions? Do you think that the boys like that? Do you think the boys are going to continue to like that as you become older? You know, I can tell you right now that they won't. So I want you to do some deep thinking about this. You know, what is it in you that makes you feel like you always have to be seen? You always have to be showy. You always have to be the smartest person in the room. And I just remember thinking, this mom doesn't get it. This mom doesn't get the radical love and acceptance that's happening here. And Piper and I left eventually, and she broke down crying, you know, just hyperventilating crying. And it was horrible. And I remember thinking, you know, as the years went on, as this first exposure to the gender expectations became clear to me, I thought back to it many times. You know, at the time I had thought it was an anomaly, but I soon came to realize that this unconditional love that I'd learned about in the community, in fact, had conditions.
So you write that you were raised hearing horror stories about harlots who destroy good, God-fearing men. Were these harlots in Bible stories, or were they also in stories about people you knew?
They were definitely in Bible stories, and we also heard them about people that we knew, but they weren't necessarily embedded into sermons. Those were more the stories that were embedded into gossip or embedded into prayer, because sometimes a prayer circle, you know, felt like a gossip circle. And, you know, it could mean all kinds of different things. It ultimately meant that you were a sexual temptation, quote unquote, to men and boys. You know, in this culture, men and boys are talked about as being sexually weak, and women and girls are supposed to be the holders of all sexual purity. So ultimately, women and girls are responsible for the sexual thoughts and feelings and choices that men make. And it's women and girls' responsibility to dress right, to act right, to talk right, to do everything just right to ensure non-sexuality for all people. And if they don't, you know, they potentially risk being categorized as impure or as a harlot.
Now, was that thought especially difficult for you during puberty when your body was changing and you were becoming more sexualized, but also the boys who you knew were becoming more sexualized? But it was all on you as a girl. You know, like if a boy gets aroused, as teenage boys do kind of constantly, that it's your fault.
Absolutely.
Like, and it's a fault. It's like it's a problem and it's your problem.
That's exactly right. And it was so important to me to be a good Christian. And so this guilting line about you're hurting them was very effective on me. You know, I heard a lot less and certainly internalized a lot less about, you know, protecting my purity, and heard a lot more, or at least internalized a lot more, about protecting their purity. You know, it was all about how you needed to be a good Christian by protecting them from the threat that is you, the threat that is your body, the threat that is your sexuality.
Can I ask if you're married?
Yes, I am, yeah.
So for you and other women who were brought up in the purity movement and with a sense of shame about your bodies, and shame and guilt surrounding anything sexual, after you and the woman you spoke to became adults and entered into, you know, marriage or long-term relationships, or left the purity movement and started having sex, was it difficult to experience sexual pleasure because of all of the guilt and shame that had surrounded the idea of sexuality for so long.
It was definitely difficult for me. You know, there was a lot of fear and anxiety that was the headline for me when I was trying to have sex. And this is something I hear a lot in my interviews as well, that pleasure is something that we have learned to be quite afraid of. And it requires a whole rewriting of our relationship to ourselves and to our bodies to be able to see pleasure as a good thing and as a valuable thing, and to be able to move through the shame and the anxiety to be able to get to it. And of course, this isn't just true of people who are raised in the evangelical church. You know, this is a much larger conversation. The purity message that I was raised with in the evangelical church is not very different than the message that we learn in society. You know, in the church, we learn that you are either pure or impure. But, you know, in society, we hear about good girls and bad girls, and we're not talking about how often they volunteer. So this is a much bigger teaching, and it impacts many more people than this community. And, you know, certainly not everyone perhaps is taking pregnancy tests, though they're not having sex, the way that I did and some of my interviewees did. But, you know, I've hardly talked to a person, you know, especially a woman, who hasn't experienced some level of sexual shame and difficulty with embracing pleasure.
Well, Linda K. Klein, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Linda K. Klein is the author of the new book, Pure. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Muj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.